Okay, today's date is June the 19th, 2013. I'm Patsy Colbert, and I'm here at the History Center with Mr. Jess Scarver, and we're going to do an oral history interview today. And Mr. Scarver, if you will, just tell me when and where you were born.
I was born on the D.C. Scarver farm in Bueller Community, 8th and 25th to 24.
Okay. And who is D.C. Scarver?
That's my dad.
Your father.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
I still live on that farm.
Oh, that's great. Okay. And what is your mother's name?
Lorena Vansall Scarver.
Okay. And was D.C. Scarver, was he, were you born and raised in Dyball then?
In Bueller.
On that farm.
On that
farm. Did your father, when did he come to Dyball?
Well.
How long was he here?
He never did live at Dyball, but I mean, he lived at Bueller.
At Bueller. Yeah. Okay. Okay.
His daddy brought him to Angelina County on Bear Creek in 1874.
Okay. So they go way back.
He's been there all of his life. He'd been there on that farm. Well, of course, it wasn't theirs for a long time. As you know, they were traveling through, going west. You know, everybody was going west back then. And they got there and they camped in 1874 on Bear Creek, and on part of my place now. And then when spring come around, and next spring, well, they headed on west. And they got to, my memory's bad, but they went about 50 miles west, and I'll give you the name in a minute when it comes to me, but they camped again, you know, they made a summer drive on, you know, well, it's probably about 100 miles out there, and they camped there, and they talked that winter, and they decided their gold mine was back in East Texas on Bear Creek. So the next spring, they got up and come back to East Texas, and that's where they've been ever since, you know. And my daddy was 2 years old when they made that trip out there, you know, and come back.
Oh, wow. Now, tell me anything else you know about Bear Creek and how it got its name.
I don't recall anything ever knowing how Bear Creek got its name. I knew there were some stories on it, but I never did know anything that was very concrete on it, you know.
So just your whole life, you've just known it as Bear Creek.
Whole life, and far as I know, back and talking to my dad, and of course, like I say, my grandpa. I remember him too. I was 11 years old when he died, and then he's the one settled the place, you know, and then my dad bought it from him, you know.
And what was your grandfather's name?
James Lawrence.
So he's the one that came here and settled on that place,
yeah,
dad?
With my dad was his oldest son, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it was three boys and one girl out of that union, but grandpa had married a widow woman, supposedly her husband had got killed. His name was Jefferson Winfield Cook, and grandpa married her when he was 21 and she was 27, and she had four children. And he married her in Louisiana, and then the next year or two they come on this way. Now I don't know just how long it was from the time they married till they headed on west, you know, with them four children plus grandpa and grandma had two.
Mm-hmm.
It was my dad and my dad and his older sister.
So 1874, that's before Dyball became.
Oh yeah, yeah.
You know, developed, and when TLL was Bueller area was.
Yeah.
There were settlers out there. You know,
there was very few settlers there then, you know. There's probably no more than what you could name on one or both hands that lived in the Bueller community when they come here, you know.
Do you know any other, the early settlers
that might have been there at the time
of your grandfather came?
No, I knew there were some squires, and I knew there were some Burrises, and And of course, that's the only ones that I can remember, you know, that was there probably when they come. I'm not sure of that, you know, okay. When they come.
And what did your grandfather do for a living?
He was a farmer and rancher and carpenter. Mm-hmm. He was a carpenter. And wait a minute. Now, he was a, what do you call a cobbler? He was a cobbler. Made shoes.
Oh.
The story I always got was he worked with his dad during the Civil War before he was old enough to go, you know, when he's a teenager, you know. And I remember as a kid that he had all of the shoe cobbler equipment. I'm talking about the old steel lash and the hammers and the nails. And he had all of the equipment to work on to build shoes.
Wow.
But he was also a carpenter.
Okay.
He was a master carpenter because he built my grandmother and grandpa's house on my mother's side over at Ball Hill. He built their house for them, and I don't know what year that was, but it was a masterpiece to look at.
Wow. Do you remember what year your grandfather died?
Are you talking about James Lawrence?
James Lawrence.
He died in 1936.
Okay. So you were pretty young.
I was 12 years old.
12 years old. Okay.
I remember it, but not a whole lot about it, you know.
And you said your dad, he was a farmer?
That's all I ever know of him doing, farming and ranching, right. Raising cows and hogs and farming, you know.
And that's how he supported his family?
How he supported his family.
Okay. Now, tell me about your schooling days. Did you go to school then at Beulah?
I went to school at Beulah through the 7th grade, yeah.
Tell me about the Beulah School, the actual building itself. Describe what you remember about the school facilities.
Well, it was Beulah School was a three-room building. It was kind of I guess you'd call it L-shaped, you know, and in the two main rooms, they had a curtain. I don't know whether it was wood or cloth, I don't know what it was. They could open it up and have an auditorium,
mm-hmm.
and or close it up and have two separate rooms, you know. And there was three teachers in that room when I started there, when I went to school there.
Do you remember who they were?
Well, I believe the first teacher I went to there was Miss Isla Grimes from Bald Hill. And the next teachers that I went to there was and I can't give you his, well, what his name was, Mr. and Ms. Cooper. They both taught there. He was principal. She taught what they call the middle grades in like 3rd, 4th, 5th, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he taught the 6th and 7th and was principal of it, you know. And I can't think of his name. I don't know his given name, but they were Coopers.
Coopers, C-O-O-P-E-R,
yeah,
Coopers.
Yeah, yeah,
okay.
Yeah. And then later, Marlon and Audrey Christopher came, and he was principal, and she taught, and I don't remember who was the primary teachers under them. I know there was somebody else teaching with them because it was a three-teacher school, you know.
Okay. And you would have started to school about 1930, if you were born in 24,
six years old. Yeah, uh-huh.
So, you know, 1930, do you remember anything else about, say, your first day of school or your, you know?
Scared to death.
Anything memorable that happened?
No, I don't know. It was pretty uneventful.
Okay. What about, did you always, now after 7th grade, then where did you go to school?
Well, the first year we came to Diboll, and I believe that was long about the first time they got a bus, you know, and we caught the bus and come to Diboll. The next year, if I remember correctly, and I could be off a little bit, but I don't think I'm off that much, the trustees in Beulah decided to go to Lefkin. They could go where they wanted to, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to Lefkin, and I don't know how many times we'd done that rotate, you know. It seemed like we come back to Diboll and could have went to Lefkin the second time. I don't know. But I graduated from Lefkin, you know.
Okay, what year did you graduate?
Oh, 42, I believe. I don't remember exactly.
Okay. That sounds about right, 42. Yeah. But you're saying you're 7th grade through Beulah, through 7th grade, and then you came to Dyball a year, and then you had the option to go to Lufkin.
And then you started going to Lufkin school. The school sent the bus to Lufkin the next year. It was their choice. The school board out there is their choice.
Beulah School Board.
I guess it had to be a deal with who would accept them too, you know. But of course they wound up making it permanent to Dyball, which.
Were you okay with going to Lufkin, or did you have a choice about it?
No, I didn't have a choice.
You didn't have a choice. It was just decided to go to Lufkin.
All people that graduated from Beulah Grammar School in those years, they either went to Lufkin or they went to Dyball.
Okay.
There could have been some that transferred, but I never did know of any of them that had a choice of it, you know.
Mm-hmm. And then, as we know, you know, later Beulah School consolidated.
That's what I'm talking about. Well, that was politics too, you know.
Yeah, and then that's the way it still is, Of course, now Beulah, we just think of it as part of Dyball, but in the early years, as you're talking about when you were born, it was kind of its separate little community out there.
Then Beulah was either Burke or Lufkin one. We had a Burke address. When I was growing up, we were Route 1 Burke. We didn't connected to Dyball in any way other than.
Because your mail went through the Burke post office.
The Burke post office.
Yeah. Wow.
And Mr. Ryan was the postman, and I don't know what his name.
Two separate directions.
All together. And then the post office got a hold of it, and they consolidated it, and then.
Right.
You know how them things go.
Right. So, anything else about your school years that you want to share?
No.
You graduated from Lufkin in 1942. Okay, and then what did you do after high school graduation?
Well, I farmed. I kept farming. See, I was farming all that time, you know, and my parents were getting old, and we kept farming, and making a living was eating what would grow, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so
you continued the tradition of farming on the Scarborough farm that your dad had.
That's right. Until I finally went to work in town, and I don't remember what year that was. Went to work for somebody up there, and they was mostly minimal jobs, you know. Wasn't much to them, you know. Long about the time I got married, then I went to work for Woods Meat Market in Lufkin, and worked there about as meat market manager for about 5, 6, 7 years.
Okay. Now, what about the service? Did you go into the service during World War II? Okay.
I went to Tyler for physical, putting 1A. And that's about the time my brother got killed in the Navy. And I put in for a deferment on that, you know, and got it, you know, for a while. But then, I don't know, I guess it was 44. I might be wrong on these dates, I don't know. They reclassified me and put me in 1A and sent me to Houston. And for a physical down there to go in the service, and I went down there and done that and come back. And somewhere in the process there, they dropped that bomb over there, and that shut it all down, you know. I never did have to go.
You never did have to go. Okay. Anything, you know, memorable or that stands out to you about those years, you know, of World War II going on? Because, you know, you were a young lad. I was out of high school, but still young.
It wasn't like it is today. I mean, if you went in here where you walked or rode horseback, or if you went out and even to church, and of course you think about young people getting together and courting and walking, but it was all walking. you walk a girl, you go to church, and if you see somebody you want to walk home with, ask them, and you walked home with them.
Walked home with them. That was a big deal. That was courting, wasn't it?
That was courting then.
Different than today, isn't it?
And you led a horse along behind you, you know.
Well, so mostly you're got around by horses.
Yeah.
Now, did you, like during that time, did you walk to school or ride your horse to school when you were in high school?
Well, I had a bus coming. When I got to high school, I had a bus coming.
But before then, like elementary years, did
you? Oh, it was all walking. It was about 9/10 of a mile from my house to Driller School, and we done all that walking.
Walked, even cold?
Cold, raining, snow, or whatever. You walked to school, you know.
What did y'all do, backing up a little bit to that, what did y'all do for lunch? Did they, you know, did you take your lunch or what?
Paper sack. Bacon and biscuit.
Bacon and biscuit.
There's a lot of that, you know. And baked potatoes. And my mother was a mighty good cook. She was cooking something all the time, you know. And we never did hurt for that. In fact, people always want to trade lunches with us, you know.
Because you had a good lunch, huh?
My mother used to make them fried pear pies.
So oh, yes, sir.
People make them out of apple now, you know. They're half moon shaped.
Yes,
you know?
Sir.
And I remember Carmen, Ricky Thompson, the youngest Thompson boy. He'd steal Prince Albert from his daddy, and he'd try to trade us a cigarette for one of them apple pies or one of them pear pies. But it was, we never did hurt for nothing to eat, you know.
Did you trade him?
At times, yeah.
At times?
I had a brother that did.
Depended, huh? Yeah. That was a pretty big trade, wasn't it?
Ricky Thompson, he'd swipe that can of Prince Albert from his daddy and papers, and we'd get off down behind the school on the branch down there and smoke, you know.
What about the heat in the building? Was it a wood stove?
A wood stove, and we took care of that, you know. I mean,
the boys had to help the teacher.
Yeah. Teachers, the principal usually would, if it was cold, they'd usually fire it up in the morning, excuse me, before we got there, you know, and have it warmed up. But the boys, they would always assign somebody to go get more wood or put more wood in the heater or whatever, you know. It was always a wood heater.
Right.
All the way through grade school, through the seventh grade, you know.
Yeah, yes. Now, talking about your, you know, when you got out of high school and you went to work, you just started continuing the farming life.
Well,
that
yeah,
your dad
for several years, yeah.
Had
yeah.
What kind of crops did y'all grow?
Well, we grew cotton and corn, and then of course we grew peanuts and peas and fatten hogs and for feed purposes, you know. And we tried to grow enough cotton to pay the bank note off. We'd usually borrow money to make a crop every year, you know. And I wound up going to First State Bank when I was about, 17 or 18. And my dad was getting old. You know, he was pretty old. And I got a credit with the First State Bank, and I'd just go up there and get what we needed, you know, and what I could get the banker to let me have, you know. And make a crop and go pay it off, you know.
Make a crop. Tell me about making a crop. What does that mean? What does that, you know, for somebody like me that doesn't know anything about being part of making a crop of a cotton crop, tell me what that consists
of.
Well,
of course, we had some problems with cotton farming back then because they had the boll weevil, they were working on that, the PMA and all that was working on that. But we usually tried to grow enough cotton to send it to the gin and sell it to pay the notes that we made that year, you know.
Make your money.
We pretty well grew everything we eat at home, including cornmeal, except flour and coffee, and that's about all we really had to buy, you know.
Now, how many acres did you say?
Well, there was 106 acres in that. That's what my dad called it at that time, you know.
And how much of that was for farming?
Oh, there was about 30 acres of it was farming.
Okay. So as far as the cotton crop, How many acres would that consist?
Well, of course, it got smaller, you know, and I can't think what they called it now, but the government got involved in it, you know. They got to plowing up cotton, you know, one time, you know. They'd pay you to plow it up, you know, kind of like they'd pay you to kill them cows, you know.
Yeah.
And
was that the public works deal
It was Roosevelt, you know. That was when he come in they'd come out, they'd send a man out to measure your cotton crop, you know, and if you had two or three rows too much or an acre too much, you had to plow it up, you know.
Oh, wow. So you were only allowed so many acres of cotton.
Yeah, and whatever you made on it, well, that was it, you know.
Mm. I guess, was that so that everybody would have equal...
No, that didn't have nothing to do with that. It was just government power, that's all it was, you know.
So when did you plant cotton or grow cotton? What season? Summer?
Do you remember the whippoorwill hollering? You remember whippoorwills hollering?
That sounds familiar.
Ship flew off the white oak at night.
Yes, sir. Yeah. You
know, late in the evening.
Uh-huh.
And that was a standard that we always heard, that when you hear the whippoorwill holler, you could plant peas and cotton and things that frost wouldn't hurt. Now, frost wouldn't hurt corn unless it froze it, you know. You could plant corn, get it up. It can get frostbitten. It just come on, you know. But if it froze down the ground, it'd kill it. But that cotton, when it come up, a frost, when it bit it, well, it was all gone.
And you couldn't afford for that to happen.
Well, no. So you wanted to wait. And that was one of the things that I remember we used, the whippoorwill hollering.
Waiting for the whippoorwill.
I never known of it or never heard nobody known of it frosting after you heard the whippoorwill holler.
That's one of those old-timey sayings.
That's an old-timey, yeah.
So it usually doesn't frost after the whippoorwill.
That's right.
So that's early spring?
That's that's mid-spring. Early spring is when you plant corn. That's I'm talking about in late February and March, you know.
Uh-huh.
But usually you don't plant cotton till around the 1st of April or later, you know.
Okay. And then how long does it take to grow?
Well,
until it's ready for harvest.
I never did hear a date on that. I don't remember, you know, but... usually was picking cotton in the last of August, you know.
Okay. Well, that's several months there then for it to grow.
Yeah, several months for it to grow. And, of course, over on Renfro Prairie, well, the prairie dirt was a little different. And they could plant a little bit earlier. And you know Irvin DuBose?
Yes, sir.
His grandpa... No, his daddy. His daddy raised cotton, and that's how we made our money for school clothes and extra money was picking cotton for Clifford DuBose, because his always come off in the middle of August or a little before, you know. We could pick cotton for him for two or three weeks before we had to pick it at home.
Before yours was ready, so you had that time. You go pick for him, make a little extra money.
And, of course, we'd pick for other people a little bit, but mainly I remember picking for him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd make enough money, and, of course, we was picking for... I believe I can remember picking some for 50 cents a hundred.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I can remember picking quite a bit for a dollar a hundred, you know. And that's where we made our clothes money. And of course we helped out with the stuff around the house too, but we'd buy brogan shoes and overalls to go to school on, you know, picking cotton, you know.
Right. Now, how many would it take to pick your cotton crops? I mean, how many workers did you have for your farm?
We always picked all our own pretty well, you know, because we
consist of who? Your brothers, sisters, how many?
We consist of my brother, mainly, of course, them older brothers, they picked two ahead of me, but Normally there was about four or five families picking, you know.
Okay, so it was just pretty much your family that did all the picking.
All of our picking, you know.
On your picking, okay.
Now me and Willie George, you know him.
I'm not sure.
But he's a banker in Henderson now, he's in bad shape. But me and him and my brother, just older than me, we'd pick a bale of cotton every 2 days for Clifford Dubow. And a bale of cotton was about 1,200 pounds, you know, that you haul to the gym.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd pick for him, and usually we'd pick a bale every 2 days, you know.
Wow. And where was the gym?
Well, when I first remember, there was a gin or two at Huntington, one I know, and there was two there at one time, but I remember one being there, and then there was one at Burke.
Mm-hmm.
It was an old Havard gin up there, and I remember going to it, and then there was two gins in Lefkin, I know.
Okay. So there wasn't a gin in Beulah, convenient.
No,
you had to take it. And how would you haul it?
You had that wagon bed was about the size of this table, you know, and it had frames on it just about this high, you know, and made out of 1x12s, you know, and you'd back it up to that cotton house and you'd start putting it in there and take you a bucket of water, you know, and you'd
take off to the gin.
What you had to do first is get one or two in that wagon to tromping that cotton down, you know, and because you couldn't just pile in a 1,200 pound bale of cotton in there, it wouldn't go, you know, it's fluffy, mm-hmm. you know, and sprinkle a little water on the edge of that, where that frame was, you know, sprinkle a little water on it and let a little get on the cotton and take your feet and tromp it down and it'd stick to them planks, you know,
oh.
And you could pack it in there and get 1,200-1,300 pounds on the wagon, you know.
Oh, wow.
And when you got it packed in there, well, usually you'd done that the day before, evening late before. You'd pack that cotton in that wagon, and the next morning you'd hook the team to it and head to Lefkin or to Burke, or I don't ever remember us going to Huntington. Mainly it was Burke or Lefkin.
Wow.
Right where the... No, you don't remember where the Libman's lot was in Lefkin.
No, sir. Yeah. I do know where the one was located in Burke, because I've done research on that. It's across from my cousin's house.
Yeah. I've tried to. You can't look right drive by the road and see where it's at, because I've looked for that, you know, and I can't find it. But I know where it's at. But you know where City Hall is there in Lefkin now?
Yes, sir.
Where the pay window is?
Yes, sir.
Go in to pay your bill. Right straight across that street there was Jordan Gin. I believe that was Jordan. I know there was Jordan Gin in town, and I could be wrong on that name, but there was a gin out there, and that's the one we always used.
Yes.
And then right across towards Regis Bank there, in that vacant lot, was what they call Libman's Lot. And that was he was a horse trader, mule trader. You could go there and buy a pair of mules or trade, or there's a trader, and they'd beat you, you know.
Do you remember what the, you know, what you were paid for the cotton? Do you remember any amount?
Well, the cheapest I ever remember, and I think was about 6 cents a pound, baled, ginned and baled. And the gin usually took so much of the seed for their work, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember whether there was any charge to that or not. I can't place any, but in other words, they'd take part of the seed or whatever, you know, for the ginning of it, you know. And then when I first can remember, they had you've heard the word fair to middling?
Yes, sir.
Didn't know what it was, probably. But anyway, they would roll up a little ball of that fresh bale cotton, about that big, you know, and they had little tubes that they'd put it in, you know, and about that long. Put that under your arm, go downtown to the cotton traders down there. They were cotton traders all over town. Cotton buyers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you had your preferences or find one that paid more when you went to him, you know. And he'd take that cotton and what they call it the staple of it, where they pull it, you know,
mm-hmm.
and how long it would pull, you know, Delta Pine was the longest staple pulling cotton that I ever knew of, you know, and there might have been some others, but that's all I. And now the half and half, oh, it was easy to pick, and it was it would open up good and all, a lot better than a Delta Pine. Delta Pine would make a longer staple. You'd get a little more, you'd get a half a cent more pound or something, maybe a little more than that for it, than you would half and half, you know. And that, when they'd get that piece of that cotton out of that little roll that you had under your arm, you know, and they'd work it out, you know, and pull it and see how long the staple, how long it would stay together, you know. And that was how they judged what the quality of it was, you know.
Wow.
And that was, of course, that was into making thread to make cloth with.
So you would try to sell your cotton to a cotton buyer.
Well, we did. You didn't have no choice.
Okay, that was what you did. And then you took it to the gin?
No, that's after you left the gin.
After you left the gin.
Yeah.
Okay. You had to get it gin, and then you sold it like that.
Well, you got it gin, and they baled it in a bale. It was about that long, I guess, and nearly that wide. But it was packed. I mean, you couldn't even poke a finger in it. It was just packed so tight. And then they put steel bands around it to hold it. You know, it was. In other words, there'd be between 500 and 600 pound of pure seed-free cotton, and they'd pack it, and then they'd put those bands around it for transportation.
Right. Okay. And then you would sell it to the buyer, cotton buyer.
You'd take this, hank, I believe they call it. You take that. You take that to the cotton buyer, and he'd look at that and pull it, you know, and draw on it, you know, and decide how much he'd give you for it. And he could pretty well, if he was a quality man that knowed what he was doing, he could tell you if it was Delta Pine or half and half, you know.
So there were different species of cotton.
Oh yeah, yeah. That was the two main one. Everybody liked to pick half and half cotton. It was good picking cotton.
It was easier.
Easier to pick, come out of the bowl good, you know. Now Delta Pine you get a little more per pound, maybe half a cent or whatever, you know. And you, of course, you want to try to get all you could, you know. And Delta Pine went over big for a while, you know. But half and half was some of the prettiest cotton that I ever worked with, you know.
Do you remember when the cotton growing stopped? I mean, do you remember your last crop of cotton and what year that would have been, or you know how old you were, maybe? Or
well, it was probably about I don't know. I'd be guessing on some of that, you know. About 46, you know, last cotton crop that I had, I imagine.
Okay. And so, of course, that would be the hot summertime when you're having to pick the cotton, you know. And I've heard my grandmother, you know, tell stories about picking cotton.
And of course, before it got down to just me and my dad, well, he was always looking for the kids to come in from school. So you got in from school, you change clothes and you get your cotton sack and go, you know.
So you picked it in the evening after school.
Picked it in the evening. You'd done whatever was to be done. You done it. You dug potatoes. You done it. You know, cut wood or whatever. You know.
So since you brought that up, can you tell me, as a child growing up, you know, the chores that you had to do, you know, before you went to school or after school?
Of course, the time I got. I'd say 10 years old, every morning I usually had to milk the cows before I went to school. That was about all you had to do in the morning was feed the horses or mules or whatever, and milk the cows, you know. Of course, in the evening it was get wood and tend to the chickens and tend to the hogs. I got pretty young, I got broke in on milking the cows, you know.
Right.
And I never did mind. I never did mind to milk cows, you know. It was
And then after school, it was whether it was farming or
whether it was digging potatoes or fixing fence or cutting more wood or whatever. Right. It was till dark, you know.
Right.
It wasn't no lights then. Wasn't no electricity.
Okay.
When it got dark, it's dark. Now there was a lamp light in the house, but I believe it was about 44 or 45 that the electricity come to Bueller, you know. I'm not exactly sure on that, but the power company could probably give us more on that. But it was about that time, you know. Could have been a little bit earlier than that, yeah.
So you would have been out of high school by then, so yeah, you had to do all your studying.
All our studying, you done at night. You done it by a lamp light or fireplace. You know, I've done some studying by fireplace. Mm-hmm. You know, just keep farming in the cold wintertime, you know.
Now, the farming, and then y'all had cattle. You raised cattle during all this time, too. So that was another means of income for your dad, raising his family.
Yeah, we didn't have a bunch of cattle, but usually we had 10 or 12 or maybe 15 grown cows, mm-hmm. and sometimes a bull, sometimes they would have a bull. But we didn't try to grow a big bunch of them. You know, when the yearlings would get up big enough to sell, well, there was always a cow buyer coming by and wanting to buy them, you know.
You just make a little money.
Make a little cash money for other stuff, you know.
Okay.
And same way with hogs, you know, we'd grow a field of peanuts and what they called them, hog peanuts, because they were peanuts that would stay in the ground without coming up, you know, in the rain. Now, what we see now is mainly is hay peanuts, and they called them hay peanuts then, and I guess they still do now. You get that crop of peanuts made, and you plant them kind of early. You didn't use hay peanuts to try to fatten hogs with.
Okay.
You could fatten them on them, you know, but I mean, you didn't, because they wouldn't stay in the ground. They get matured, and the ground get a little bit dry, and then it come a pretty good rain, pretty good shower of rain. Every one of them would come up before you could get them up, you know. But now them hog peanuts, what we call hog peanuts, and what the difference is, I don't know. But they were a bigger peanut, and they were, I remember one name was Georgia Runners that we bought. Mom and Papa ordered the seed from some seed company, I don't know. But now it was good to grow, to turn hogs in on them, let them root them up and eat them, get fat. Grow, yeah.
Before you butchered them.
Before you butchered them or sold them or whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you did some of that too, sell the hogs?
Yeah, we, when you get to needing a little money when there was usually some special need come up, well, Papa would come to commissary and talk to the butcher out there in the commissary and asked him, do you want to need a fat hog brought in dressed, you know? Mm-hmm. And I'd take it in the morning or a certain morning, he'd engage it, you know. We'd get up and heat that pot of water and kill that hog and lay that hog in that wagon, wash that wagon out, and then mm-hmm. we'd put clean sheets in that wagon and lay that hog in there and cover him up.
Wow.
And they'd bring him to the commissary, you know.
Here in Dyball?
Here in Dyball, yeah. I remember that happening.
Do you remember the butcher? I mean, who was it that bought him?
I can't think of the... See, I didn't know. I was...
You were a young boy then?
I was a young boy when that was going on. And of course, my older brothers, John D. and Bertie Swanick, got killed in the Navy. There was a hit of me on that, you know. But I remember several times, and you hear old Loretta Lynn singing about Daddy killing a hog, selling a hog.
Yes,
well,
sir.
we've done that.
Done
you know?
That, right. Now, did you, did that happen most of your growing up life? I mean, you remember common thing. Did other people do that too?
Up until about 45, yeah.
Or did they just have certain, like the commissary, the butcher, did he just have certain people that he bought hogs from because he knew they were probably
well,
raised
he,
or something.
He learned pretty fast some he didn't want to buy them from. Okay. You know, we had one neighbor too that I know that wouldn't clean his hogs good. You know.
Okay, so that made a difference.
And
yeah.
That made a difference, right. You know. And but it was the butcher's that comes there. It was his choice.
His choice.
And
okay.
He knew that if it wasn't clean, he didn't want it. You
right.
Know?
Okay.
And I had some neighbors that. I knew they'd get them about half clean. That's good enough. Let's cut them up.
Now, I want you to go back to the peanuts for a little bit and tell me a little bit more about growing peanuts. And, you know, was that common around here?
It was common. Didn't everybody do it? I don't remember people like Clifford Dubose, one that raised it, mm-hmm. mainly cotton and corn. I don't remember him growing peanuts, but he might have. I don't say he didn't. But
did you raise enough to sell?
No, we didn't sell. We raised
for yourself.
We only raised peanuts for we raised hay peanuts to put hay in the barn and leave the peanuts on them. Then we'd pick them off in the wintertime, you know.
Okay.
And eat them or whatever we needed to do with them, you know. But usually we fed them to the animals, you know.
Fed
the hay peanuts and all, you know.
Okay.
But we picked off what peanuts we wanted, you know.
But we'd eat them, too.
We eat parched peanuts a lot in the winter.
Yeah, yeah.
But we grew, I'd say, between 3 and 4 acres of hog peanuts. I'm talking about hog peanuts now. I mean, we never did dig. They stayed in the ground, and the hogs rooted them up and ate them and got fat on them. And we'd had that was fenced off.
So that was just a natural, source of a food plot for them. To help
but
you
we had
fat.
Wow. We had about 6 or 8 acres in that. We called it the kitchen field because it was on that side of the house, you know.
Okay.
And about half of it was cleared, and that's where we put peanuts, you know, and peas. Chicken peas, we raised peas for the chickens to eat, you know.
Yes, sir.
And then we'd have a little corn in there with it, mix it in there, you know. Raw corn, raw peanuts, and but on the back side of that 7 or 8 acres of it. Excuse me, there was I don't know who built it, but I'm sure my dad was involved in it. What they built a community. Hog pen. I say it was community. Uh-huh. They probably built it for themselves. But it was in the corner of that block of land there, there was they took poles like these pine poles, only they used hardwood mostly, and they built a wing that goes out, you know, here was the fence coming down here. Here's the corner. Let me get it. That's all right. But right in here would be a hog pen, and you'd take and you'd build a wing out this way for 50, 60, 70 feet, you know, and you'd have a pretty good sized hog pen here, and then you'd have a little one right in the corner that you squeezed them into to either load them out or do whatever you wanted to, and mark them. We marked the pigs.
Oh, okay.
And all the community used that hog pen. They didn't come ask. They just, if they needed to pen their wild hogs and take care of them, mark them, or load them out, or carry them to the house. They just used
it. Yeah, but it was on your property. Yeah,
it was on the very corner of our
property.
Property. Yeah.
And other people used it.
And old man Charlie Sullivan, R. Black, Zolly McDuffie penned lots of hogs there.
What was your hog mark?
Swallow, fork, and right, split, and over bit, and the left.
Say that again. For the tape, say that again.
Swallow, fork in the right.
Uh-huh.
Split, over bit in the left.
Okay. Okay. Because, you know, in other interviews I've heard people, you know, mention their mark. Mm-hmm. About how many hogs would y'all have? Would you mark?
We'd mark all the pigs every spring, you know.
Okay.
And of course, they wouldn't all survive, and some would go here and some would leave, some, you know, but... we usually I'd say an average of 12 or 15 sows, you know, in the woods, you know. But my dad would take we called it a corn wallet. We called it a wallet, but it was a corn wallet is what it was. And you could throw it across the saddle horn. It had a slit in the it was like this, and it had a slit here in the middle, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you put it was a sack on each end. It would hold about a water bucket full of ear corn. Ear corn, you know.
Right.
And you'd put that ear corn in that wallet and throw it across the saddle or throw it across your shoulder, which we did that too, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd go see about them hogs pretty regular, you know, every 10 days or 2 weeks or whatever. Take the dog, go up there and bail them up. And they would...
So that wallet thing you're talking about, that would help bring them to you.
Well, when you got that corn out there and fed them a time or two, well,
yeah.
they remembered that corn.
Right, right.
And that was
right. Now, what would you do if you pinned a hog that didn't have your mark? You released it because it didn't belong?
It just went back out, you know.
Just went back out. So everybody was respectful of your neighbor's mark.
We didn't have no... I never did have sure of anybody... stealing any hogs in that area in there. Now, I heard of it happening in places,
right.
You know.
Okay.
In fact, been up Bear Creek, I heard of some going on, but I never did know nothing about it.
Okay.
You know?
So farming, cattle raising, hog raising, peanuts, cotton.
Chickens. Yeah.
Just typical farm life.
Yeah,
but
that's right.
But in the means where it provided a living for your father.
Yeah,
and then you continued that on after.
Back then, you know, they nobody had no insurance. Nobody seen a doctor. They seen
right.
a doctor. If it,
right,
I,
right.
I, my oldest brother, and you probably might remember him, he was operated on for appendicitis in that old house there by the coil of light.
In your parents' house?
In the old homestead that's still standing there.
Well, now tell me your siblings, name them for me.
Oh, my siblings. Yeah. Well, Samantha, Virginia, Scarborough, George. I'll try to give you all of it, you know, that way. She was Scarborough. She married a George, and Verdon, Green, Scarborough, and Alice, Sybil, Scarborough, Nichols. And Aline Scarborough Jones, Cora Aline Scarborough Jones. And then I had a brother that was born that didn't live but about 2 or 3 months, and his name was Vansaw Scarborough below Aline. And then Emma Claudine Scarborough Rice. She is born in 13. John D. Scarborough was born in 16. I didn't give you those other numbers, but
that's okay.
And then Bertie Smoy Scarborough and Holland Scarborough and myself, and then Ruth Geraldine Scarborough Christopher was a baby.
Okay.
11 of us.
11 of you. Wow. Big family. Big family. Okay. And, okay. Anything else about the farming life that you want to share with us? Anything particular you know about, you know, your dad and the struggles he had with farming or struggles you had? Did you ever lose a cotton crop? I wanted to ask you that.
I don't remember ever completely losing a cotton crop. Or corn crop either. Now, one year we planted the corn two or three times, and it rained, it flooded out,
oh, wow.
Scalded out, and I don't know whether it was my dad or me, went to town and bought some corn seed that was supposed to grow fast, and then we planted it, and we made enough to feed the team. That was always after, and make a little corn meal,
mm-hmm.
And that was... that's the only time that I come almost failure making a corn crop.
Okay. Now, you mentioned a team. Tell me what that means.
Team means...
What you're referring to?
Refers to two work animals, you know. when I was growing up, it was two mules and one horse that was used primarily for riding, you know.
Okay.
And then later, when those mules, well, one of them died, and then I wound up buying a horse and a mule, and I worked them a few years at last, you know, and then I had a riding horse.
Okay. Now, in later years, you know, after you got out of high school and you started the farm, like, did you, you know, what do you remember, you know, did you go to a tractor rather than the team?
I never went to
a
tractor there. Okay. There was always,
so you always farmed with the team?
Always farmed with the team there, yeah.
Okay.
And, of course, the land was divided, and I moved back down there. I finally got a tractor and did raise a little corn and stuff, but that was after I'd went to work for a company.
Okay, okay. And so you still live on this on the farm. Is it still 106 acres, or has it been?
Well, that part of that land, part of that 106 acres, is not the region that we lived on. There was a 50-acre block off of this same survey that Grandpa settled that my uncle and his wife wound up with. And he sold it to my mother's daddy, which was my grandpa on my mother's side. And he bought it to make money, you know, bought it from my uncle. And he sold it to old man Ben Shivers, and I've got part of that place back, making up mine, and there's part of that that I was raised on that I won't ever get, you know.
Okay.
I wound up with about 108 or 10 acres.
Okay. But the house that you were raised in?
It's still standing in the original place.
Still standing in the original place. And do you own that? Is that the part
well,
you have
no,
now?
That
that's
was,
the part of the you're talking about that you don't have.
When my mother and father died, the sisters, they wanted to keep the old home place intact, mm-hmm. and so they decided to survey 1 acre off there and keep it, you know. Might have been a mistake. Sometimes I think it was, you know, because had nobody done much to it except myself.
It's just still existing, but you don't use it for anything?
No.
Okay.
We used it for a while and kept electricity in it, but mm-hmm. finally the electricity went out. Moy D. Scarver, you remember him?
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
He worked on it some, he didn't do the physical work, but he worked on getting it restored, you know, getting a new roof put on it. And, of course, the roof was good. It wasn't that bad. This was about a year before we died, and he'd been dead about 2 or 3 years. But
so
anyway.
If it's still standing and it was built in,
95.
1895? Wow.
It had one cypress shingle roof on it when it was built.
Wow, that's pretty interesting.
And then we put a metal roof on it in the 40s, and then we replaced it here last year, year before last.
Yes, sir.
Just before Moy D. died.
Okay. Do you have a photograph of it in its, you know, in early days? That would be interesting to see a photo of it. If you had one, we'd be interested in seeing that. But
I don't know. I don't know whether I've got a photo. I've got a drawing of it.
That'd be interesting.
And it might not. That wouldn't be. See, it was a dog trot house. It is
right.
A dog trot house.
Right.
And it had a dining room and a kitchen off to one end out there. It made the dog trot, you know.
Uh-huh.
And in the 40s, we tore that down and changed the roof to where we just have straight roof on it.
Oh, okay.
It doesn't look, and I don't know whether I've got a picture of the original there or not.
Okay.
But it was a dog trot, and it's still a dog trot. The dog trot's still there.
Now, tell me about what you remember about the Depression years.
Well,
you would have been just a kid in school still.
There was a lot of people that suffered through the Depression, apparently. But I never did know nothing about that. I never did go hungry, you know.
Raised all your food, father did.
I always had a pair of overalls to wear. They might have a hole in the knee, but this ventilation, we didn't think much about it. Every person you met down the road, he might have a hole in both knees, you know. So you didn't think nothing about it? I didn't know.
Wasn't really anything that you thought was different than your typical farm life?
Wasn't anything extraordinary for me that we went through. Just everybody went through it.
Oh, right. Okay. Now, since you're familiar with the Beulah area and born and raised out there and still live there today, what can you tell me about the old beef trail? We seem to get a lot of research.
Well, a lot of that's imaginary stuff, I think. Okay. You know, I mean, and people like to talk about that now. What I knew or heard about the old beef trail that I accepted anyway, that it kind of pretty well run close to where 1818's at, you know. Now,
I was just curious if, since your family, you know, goes so far back, if you heard your grandfather or your father, any stories about the beef trail.
You know, and they had a camp, a corral over there on somewhere around Prairie Grove. I don't know whether you've heard that story before.
No, sir, not. I know where you're talking about, but
I'm trying to think of those folks' name. Stovall's. And it was my understanding that it's somewhere in about where they lived in there would be West Prairie Grove Cemetery and Church in there. They supposed to had a corral there that they could pin them cattle in, you know, when they come in. And of course, I heard some pretty wild stories about some people breaking them out and some people doing this and doing that. And I don't know that any of it was true.
Okay.
You know?
Okay.
One story I heard some of the neighbors in the neighborhood would take a cat or something and tie papers. Something to his tail and set it on fire and throw it out in that cow pen to make them break out, you know, where they'd have to spend more time gathering them and bringing them back, you know. I've heard that tale. I don't know if it ever happened.
So that corral was the place they corralled them in and then...
Would they
sell them at that point?
No. They were just resting.
To move on.
To move on, yeah. Okay. And I heard that there was the place there that, you know, they had rent the cowboys the place to sleep.
Okay, like just going through on the trail.
Passing through.
Old beef trail, yeah. Okay.
Now there's, but like I say, that was before my time, okay. And I never did.
Okay. I was just curious if you heard any stories, you know, from
now, there's one other thing that I'll mention here that you might not have heard or you might hear later if you keep talking to somebody, is my dad went to school at Red Branch Schoolhouse.
Okay.
Have you ever heard that name before?
Yes, sir.
And I know about where it was at. Olin Blake knows about where it's at. But I had never been there lately. I was there when I was a kid. That'd be up Bear Creek from where I live, about 2 miles from the house. But at Red Branch come off of Bear Creek, and there was a schoolhouse up there. And do you know where anybody lives? You know where Ralston McDuffie lives?
No, sir, but Mr. Capps, Marshall Capps, came in one day researching Red Branch, and I believe he brought a photograph or was in search of a photograph, maybe.
Pearl.
That's how I became, and Miss Pearl Everett.
Pearl Everett had a picture of people that were supposed to went to school there, but...
I believe Mr. Capps brought that, and he was trying to, you know, figure out the exact location of that school. That's how I became familiar with the school being out there.
I don't think you could ever find that location now.
But it was in the Beulah community out there.
Well,
your dad attended there. Is that what
your father attended
there?
My dad attended there. And a lot of the family did because they didn't go to school much.
The location.
They had people that was raised in around Prairie Grove. In fact, the business in the It'd be on the up the creek from Bueller, you know, up the creek from where I was born and raised, is a crow flies, probably about 3 miles, and then northeast of Prairie Grove, that community in there, where there was a.
Do you know if he went to school there, you know, the whole time, or was it just there for a short time, and then he went to Bueller, your dad, or where did your
dad? No, they were living at Bueller, and he went to school there for, I think, several years, you know, but they didn't go but third or fourth grade, you know, and then they'd go to work, you know, and they didn't get much schooling in the schoolhouse out there.
Right, okay. Okay. Now, you mentioned the Stovalls, and are you related to the Stovalls? Okay. Do you know about the... anything about the Stovall plantation that
well,
you want to share
of it,
with?
But I don't. I never could. I've heard of it in later years. I had never heard of it before. You know.
Okay. So, like, when you're growing up and your years of farming, it wasn't like you were close to this supposed the Stovall plantation.
I never did know nothing about it.
Okay.
It's
J.W. Stovall. He mentioned his grandparents had 640 acres and slaves, and that's where the Dave. The slave named Dave, you know, comes in through this family.
Yeah, he buried at Prairie Grove.
I was just wondering if you had any, you know, memories of that you wanted to share with me. Okay.
No, I think that was mainly around Prairie Grove.
Prairie Grove area.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And of course,
that's where the slaves buried anyway. Supposedly, you know, that's where the tomb is. I've seen it. I'm on the cemetery board out there.
So it's like in the early days, Bueller and Prairie Grove were two separate little communities.
That's right.
Like
yeah.
Burke and Ryan Chapel, but then today they're all kind of one. Same thing with Bueller and Prairie Grove, I guess.
It was like, you know, it was Bueller and Fairview and Bueller and Ball Hill and Bueller and Prairie Grove and Bueller.
All those little rural
Bueller and Shawnee Prairie and Bueller and Olive. Do you remember Olive?
I just know of it through the school photo, school history. Olive School.
I remember when the Olive School disbanded and come to Bueller.
Okay.
And that was, I don't remember the date, but I remember in Thurman Strain, I think, was the bus driver there pretty soon after that happened, you know.
What, how old were you? Like, were you at grade school?
Yeah, I was in grade school.
So you remember the students from Olive coming?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Lila Mae Hambrick was one of them, you know.
Okay.
And
you remember about what grade you were in?
Well, I don't know for sure, but I'd have to do some guessing on that. Probably in the third, fourth, or fifth grade, you know, something. Because the time she graduated from grammar school, seventh grade, well, Thurman married her, you know, so
that'd
she
be
was
like,
about 14 years old.
1933,
yeah, in that neighborhood somewhere.
But your memory is that just here's these Olive kids.
Oh, yeah. I remember them coming. And they,
do you remember why they closed the Olive School? Was it because they closed it, I guess?
Well, I never did know exactly why they closed it, unless it got small, you know, wasn't that many people down there. And, I imagine it was a price thing for the county school, board to keep supporting it, you know.
How far was Olive from Bueller?
Olive School from Bueller School, as you went the road, it was probably about 4 or 5 miles.
Okay.
Yeah, it wasn't that far. I'd say Olive School. Well, you know anything about that country out there?
Just the Bueller, just 1818, you know, the Grimes Road, you know, that area.
Grimes Cemetery Road. Olive was down at Grimes Cemetery Road, about 3 miles from where you live, 58.
Okay.
And, of course, the Bueller School was up there. You know where it was.
58, yes, sir. Okay. Anything else about the Bueller community, you know, that, you know, we've talked about the school. You know, what was there in Bueller when you were a kid before, you know, you come to Dieball to the commissary? Was that common to come to the commissary to purchase things that you're, like, do you remember your parents, course, your mom and dad would have come to the commissary?
When I first can remember, Wilma Grimes had a grocery store there in Bueller, but I mean, about all you got there was flour and coffee and a little gasoline if you wanted it. If somebody, if you didn't have a car, we didn't have none of that, but mainly you come to Dyball.
To Dyball. But the little Grimes grocery, you would just get basic.
It started out as just a minimum array of things, you know.
Okay.
Just, you could buy a few things, you know.
Was it a big deal if you were coming to the commissary?
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Because
did you come? Did your dad come? Did you come horse and buggy?
Wagon.
Wagon. Come with the wagon.
Yeah, you would come with wagon.
So, as a kid, what's your memory of the commissary store? Coming into Dyball to
it was just a big building for me,
big,
you know,
building.
And I hated to see it go.
Out,
but
right.
And I didn't come in as a kid with him that much, you know. But when we'd kill hogs in the wintertime, well, we'd wind up with a lot of pork bones, you know. And a lot of times he would had a wagon sheet or something. He'd put it in that wagon and. And he might have put some kind of leaves or something in there, and he'd put them pork bones in there and bring them to the quarters, you know, and peddle pork bones, you know.
Right. Do you remember Mrs., you know, some of the people in the commissary, like Miss Farrington, or?
Well, I remembered the name, you know, mm-hmm. Let's see, who was that? No, I can't put it on my mind.
The butcher, you know, Mr. Cruthers.
Yeah. Cruthers, yeah, I remember him, yeah.
Okay.
But, of course, faintly, I was pretty small, you know.
Did your father ever work for Southern Pine Lumber Company?
To my knowledge, he never did, you know. Now, he might have worked a little, but if it was summer job, we'd call it, or, you know, mm-hmm. just temporary. I don't think he ever worked for, I don't think he ever held a public
just
job.
Just farming. As your grant, okay. And then what about your working career? Did you ever work for Southern Pine Lumber Company?
No, I went to work for the handle factory one time, but I didn't stay there. I couldn't handle it back then for, I think it was 32 cents an hour.
Oh, my goodness. So after high school and you continued, you know, the farming, and you went to work in Lufkin, what was your career, mostly your working career?
Well, mainly after I went to work in Lufkin, it was butchering, you know. I went to work for Woods Meat Market, you know.
Okay.
But that was right after I got married, yeah.
Okay. How long did you stay there?
I worked for Woods Meat Market about 5 or 6 years. I don't know exactly, but last of 48 up to about beginning of 54.
Okay. And then what'd you do after that?
I went to work for Natural Gas Pipeline Company in 1950. No, that was 53. In April of 53, and I retired from them in February of 86.
February of 86, wow.
33 years.
33 years, okay. And that's the natural gas pipeline that's out on Farm Road 58? Okay. And what did you do for them? What did your work consist of?
Well, I first went to work in the pipeline department. That was just maintenance, you know, just painting posts or whatever mm-hmm. you do. You know, I mean, you just were, you know, went out every day and worked, you know. There wasn't no station there. But they started building that station in 1953 when I went to work for them.
Okay.
And when they got it completed, well, I transferred into the station and was an oiler, what they called an oiler back then, and all that was consist of is keeping things cleaned up and painted and oiled and, mm-hmm. and checking the engines ever so often.
Yeah,
and,
wow.
And I put in 20 years in there, and that's got me wound up with asbestosis because I had to get it. And then I got an opening and transferred back to the pipeline department. And the last 10 years I spent in the pipeline department.
Okay. 33 years.
33 years.
Okay.
Really. It lacked just a month or two being 33 years. I think it lacked from February the 28th to April the 6th, to be exact, you know.
Okay. And I know the Scarborough family, you know, is well connected to Beulah, and it's quite a big family, right? Quite a lot of branches of the Scarborough family around.
Well, they
and
they,
still in Beulah, is
well,
that correct?
No, no, there's none of them. None of them. I'm the only one there.
Oh, okay, okay. And tell me your.
Well, of course, there's. You know, wait a minute. There's some of the Scarborough family there, because my dad's brother's family, they still have some of them there. Bug Scarborough. You remember Bug Scarborough?
That sounds familiar. Tell me, going back to the Grimes store at Beulah, tell me a little bit more about that and what you remember about that. And then also, can you share with me about the Dubose grocery store? Because I know as a child myself, that was always, you know, the stop out there was the Dubose grocery.
Yeah, I don't know exactly when CB bought the store from the Grimes, but CB kept it a long time. It was... I can't give you a date on it, but I knew that when I was first grew up there, well, it was Grimes' store, you know, Wilmer Grimes. And C.B. Dubose, I think he had a store at Burke before then, and he went out there and bought that and done well with it. And when it was first went in, it was across 1818. From where it is now.
Oh, really?
You know where 58 butts into 1818?
Yes, sir.
If you just kept driving straight across, you'd have run into the Grimes Grocery. It was across there.
Oh, okay.
And I think there's a cypress tree out there. It was pretty close to that store. Small tree, you know, still small, but don't grow much. But it was across the road, and I don't know whether. When CB got a hold of it, I don't know whether he moved it across the road and bought that land over there, you know. Of course, that was that land where it was originally, that was owned on later what we call Calvin Grimes place. That's Wilmer's brother. He owned that land in there, you know. Curtis wound up with it.
The Grimes place, yes, sir.
Yeah. But anyway, it was... And like I say, them dates is all run together.
Yes, sir. We have that somewhere. I didn't look it up, but you know, I've done a little bit of research on the Burke grocery up there, and I knew that Mr. Dubose was at the Burke store.
He was at
with
the
Mr.
Burke
Courtney,
grocery.
I believe it was, and then went to Beulah.
And bought that store. And like I say, he might have bought
it. I'm not sure of the years either, but.
He might have bought it when it was on the south side of 1818 and then bought that land over there and built that over there. I don't know when.
But, you know, I just think of the Dubose grocery store in Beulah. That was kind of the hub, you
well,
know, of
yeah,
the community.
Everybody went, you know.
Yeah.
And that's where you went if you didn't need nothing but soda water and coffee and sometimes a little flour or something, you know. But mainly it was just pick up refreshments and whatever, you know.
Right. And a place to socialize.
Yeah, socialize. Yeah. A lot of that went on, you know.
Yes, sir. Now, what growing up, you know, what church was your family affiliated with?
My family was affiliated with a Pine Grove Missionary Baptist Church.
Okay.
For years, yeah. And they had that's a little bit of a long story, but anyway, the association, it was American Baptist Association, and they had a school in Jacksonville, and they got I guess he was president in there, and there was a fellow with him, two fellows, one of them was D.N. Jackson, and the other one was, lost his name right now. Keller, Gerald Keller. And of course, my daddy was a deacon in the Baptist church. My grandpa was a deacon in the Baptist church, and they was pretty straight on it. So I thought, well, they were. Yeah, because, these two men that I mentioned, they decided that before they could seat a church in the association, whether it was local or wherever, they're going to have a committee that would screen them. And that went red against D. Scarborough's grain, you know. And he in fact, the business, he got de-churched for it.
And they, D. Scarborough, you're referring to your father?
Yeah.
Okay.
And anybody that believed like he did was, they de-churched him. And of course that put me out too, cause I wasn't going to church then, but I was still a member there. But anyway, they have since abandoned that deal, you know.
And, right.
And they, it was their American Baptist Association has stayed pretty true, but it's fading now. I mean, I can see some things going wrong with it, but, that, when that split come in 1950, well, that group that split off wound up being what they call the NAB, North American Baptist Association. It wasn't American Baptist, it was North American Baptist Association. And of course, we had some preachers in the group that I stayed with, the American Baptist Association, that they, anything they could do to aggravates anybody, you know. But anyway, that's where the American Baptist, where the NABA, and later, at one time, before that split, the Texas Association was called the BMA Association.
Okay.
Baptist American Association, you know. And, so after they wrestled with that NABA name for about 10 or 15 years, I don't know just how long, well, they decided they'd go back to the BMA, you know, better
right.
name. They didn't like that NABBY business.
Right, right.
And they did. And, but, of course, I'm still a member of American Baptist Association, just like my dad and my grandpa.
Okay. And what church are you affiliated with now?
Well, I'm with Prairie Grove right
Prairie
now.
Prairie Grove, okay.
But it's...
And I know you do the... you volunteer with the at the nursing home?
Oh, yeah.
Singing?
In fact, I've been inside there today for two.
Now, wow. is that through your church, or is that
no,
group that y'all get together?
I had a sister that was in Pinecrest about 25 years ago. Claudine, I called her name a while ago. She was in Pinecrest. And I asked two or three ladies if they would help me sing at a nursing home, you know. And so they said, yeah. And so we started at Pinecrest, and we got some politics mixed up in that, and I told, and of course I got some ladies out of the Methodist church, and they were some Baptists and Methodists, mostly Methodists, come help me, you know. Bernice Weisinger is one of them, and her and Mildred, and they joined in with me to help me, and they still help me. Mildred's kicked out on me. She's been out for a while now. I don't know whether she'll ever be back or not. But anyway, that's not church-oriented in that sense, you know. Mm-hmm. We got just, Methodist and Baptist.
You just volunteer. And
volunteer. But we do...
that's a wonderful thing. It's great.
We do two every Wednesday, except the second Wednesday we go to Huntington. We just do one. And then fifth Wednesday, we don't do any. But we've been talking about putting some on that. But the way I got along singing today, I think we better start.
Well, that's wonderful. Well, is there anything that you'd like to share with me that I haven't asked you about?
I can't think of anything.
Okay. So. Well, you've been here all your life and... seen a lot of changes. And
we'll be 89 years in August.
Yeah, that's a blessing. That's wonderful. That's wonderful. What is one of the, I guess, if you could just point out one of the biggest changes that you've seen for Diabol in your years here that you've seen?
Well, of course, it always had to be integration, you know.
Okay.
That was one of the biggest changes that it happened in my lifetime.
In your lifetime, okay. That had a, you know, anything particular that you remember about it
to
share?
Of course, people, the black race now, if they hear the word Negro, they take it as an offense. And when I was growing up, a Negro was just a black person.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't mean that they were sorry. It didn't mean anything, you know. Never mm-hmm. has.
Right.
But, you know, they've been, politics got into that. And of course, we didn't have none out there.
Integration, right? Actually, as far as school integration, took place after you were already out of school.
Yeah.
So that's one reason I didn't specifically ask you about that. We do sometimes.
It was in the 60s, you know, when it...
You would have been in your working career then.
Yeah. And, of course, we didn't have no trouble with it. I worked for the company out there, and they started hiring some, hard two or three from Diabol, one from Cargan, and everything went fine.
Okay. But you just remember that as quite a big change.
Well, it was a change in the whole area, not particular
right.
Bueller, because they never was, until the last few years, there wasn't any lived at Bueller. I think
right.
there's a few live out there now.
Okay. Anything as far as a world event that I didn't ask you about? I asked you about World War II, Depression, but anything... You know, that stands out to you that took place that left quite an impression or quite memorable to you in world events?
It was everything was pretty quiet. We had, of course, when I was growing up, we had quite a few shinny steels in the south end of Angelina County.
Shinny steels?
You've ever heard about them?
You're talking about
whiskey steels.
Whiskey steels?
Yeah.
Well, I've read about them. I don't know about any particular ones.
I never seen but one in my life, and even in running them woods, you know, I run into one, and I didn't run into it. Some brothers run into it, and I got with them later that evening. I think it was on Sunday. And let's go to that whiskey still. Got down there, and they done seen our tracks, and they done moved it, you know. We tracked them out to 1818 and moved it in a wagon.
Oh, wow.
But there was a lot of people that done that for cash money, too. You know?
Right. Well, life was quite different, you know, in your growing up, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Than today's growing up. It was a hard life. And of course, you probably appreciate it.
It was your raising. It was a hard life. When I was growing up, you know, but you didn't think nothing about it. Everybody was the same boat, you know.
Right. Well, Mr. Stovall, I think that's all of my questions. We've gone a good bit of time here today. I appreciate you doing this interview with us. And if there's nothing else, we'll close it out.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Sounds like a winner. Thank you.